Welcome to this LexisNexis Family Law Webinar on Private Children Case Law Update 2020. My name is Emma Nash and I'm a partner at the International Family Law Group, and I'm joined by Victoria Brown, who is a solicitor at Anthony Gold Solicitors. We're going to be going through a variety of cases and topics today, and I'll just run through those for you now. We're going to be looking at foreign orders, Section 9114 orders, parental alienation, recent appeals against findings of fact, transgender issues, paternity deceit, and then if we have time, we'll have a quick look at some of the recent cases dealing with COVID-19. We're going to start by looking at foreign orders. So if I can go to the next slide, I have set out briefly the law which this case will be looking at. And that includes habitual residence and wrongful removal under Article 10 of Brussels 2A. And I've put a summary of that there, together with forum conveniens. Again, just briefly setting out the law that the court will have to consider for that principle. And then finally, which I want to focus more on, is the recognition of children orders where common law principles apply. So that's where we can't look at Brussels 2A or the Hague Convention 1996. On the next slide, I have set out briefly some of the facts of this case. So this involved a four-year-old girl who had been living in England and Wales. Her father removed her to Egypt in April last year, and left her there in the care of relatives. The mother argued that the child had been habitually resident here, and therefore the removal was wrongful under Article 10 of Brussels 2A, and that the UK had jurisdiction to hear the case. But that if they couldn't establish habitual residence, the UK was the most appropriate place to hear the issues of welfare regarding the child under principles of forum conveniens. And then there was an assessment of how the court should deal with an order made in Lebanon in earlier that year by agreement by both parents. Now, the court was quite happy to find that the child had been habitually resident in this country at the time that she was removed, and also at the time that the mother made the application, which was several months later. They also found that had they not been able to establish habitual residence for jurisdiction, then they would find that the England and Wales was the most appropriate forum for hearing the case, and that there was not any other appropriate forum. And the court looked heavily at the fact that both parents were still here and that the child was in a country, Egypt, where no one had parental responsibility for her. Finally, in assessing the order that had been made in Lebanon, which the father was trying to rely on, the court had to look at common law principles because Lebanon is not a signatory to either Brussels 2A or the Hague Convention 1996. And those common law principles, particularly in relation to children, establish that no order in relation to children is final by its nature. And that's something that we know and we take across all children cases. And also that the welfare of the child will be the leading consideration. So the court had no hesitation in establishing jurisdiction and in deciding that it could make orders in relation to this child's welfare and ordered a summary return.
In this case, Emma, what were the key determining factors when the court decided that the child was habitually resident in England and Wales? And do you think it's always so clear?
Whilst this was an unusual case in that the father had removed the child to another country and then returned back here himself, in terms of the assessment of habitual residence, the usual principles were applied. We looked at the level of integration of the child into life here, day-to-day life, school, and that assessment was relatively straightforward. I've also put on the slide the case of W and L, which is a case that came out last year, looking predominantly at forum conveniens in relation to Jordan, and there was a similar assessment there again in terms of habitual residence. So I think it's not always a clear cut on habitual residence. It was in this case, and there was nothing unusual in terms of the court's assessment.
Thank you. Moving on to slide number six, the next section I'm going to be talking about are section 9114 applications. Moving to the next slide, on this slide you'll see the exact wording of section 9114 of the Children Act, and effectively this type of order bars an individual from bringing an application in respect of a child without first seeking leave of the court. For this reason it's quite a draconian measure, and I'll discuss this in more detail. Moving to the next slide, the main cases that I'm going to be talking about are the cases of Reece 1 and C2 and Reece 3 and C4. These two cases were both heard by Mr. Justice Kean and relate to the same father, and cross-disclosure was ordered between both cases. First, taking RECI 1 and C2, the court was concerned in this case with two children, child 1, who was 2 years old, and that was the that child was the father's biological child, and I refer to them as the child, and the elder child, child 2, who was 12 years old and who had a different father. There were three applications before the court. The two applications made by the father were for a child arrangements order in respect of both children. And there was also one application by the mother for an order pursuant to section 9114 against the father to prevent him from bringing any further applications in respect of either child without first seeking leave of the court. The father in this case wanted regular direct contact with both children, which was opposed by the mother as well as the eldest child's father and the children's guardian. The father also sought findings of fact against the mother. For the purposes of this webinar, I will focus mainly on the application by the mother for a section 9114 order, and I won't really go into too much discussion about the order made in respect of direct contact, but you know, would suggest that you read the judgment in full to look at that too. Now, in terms of the factual background to this case, following the party's separation, the father's behaviour had been fairly atrocious. This included having retained his child, causing the mother to obtain a recovery order. And he'd also walked out of court on one occasion when he was unhappy with the court's proposals for the reinstatement of contact. There also followed two incidents where he turned up at the mother's property, and the latter resulted in him assaulting the mother. During the course of these proceedings, an expert psychologist had prepared a report in respect of the father, within which she diagnosed him as suffering from a narcissistic personality disorder, and that was something which he adamantly denied. He was a litigant in person, but he was also a qualified member of the bar. Despite this, his behaviour during the hearing was described by the judges appalling, aggressive, incoherent and intimidating, including the way that he cross-examined the witness. The judge said that the father was his own worst enemy, and it was some of the worst behaviour that he'd seen in court throughout his career as a judge. The father told the judge also that when his patience was gone, you could then question my judgment. And that was something that the judge identified as being really going to the heart of this case. Now, on the slide, I've set out the key findings of the court. Firstly, Mr. Justice Keane refused to order direct contact on the basis that it wasn't in either child's best interests and it was proportionate to take that step in the circumstances. And then in considering the Section 9114 application, the judge bore in mind the guidance set out in WEP, which identified the circumstances within which this kind of order can be made. Mr. Justice Keane acknowledged that the making of this kind of an order is a very serious one, and it's only to be made where absolutely necessary and where the welfare of the children require it. In this case, he was entirely satisfied that the welfare of the children required him to make a Section 9114 order upon the father, and he did so for a period of 2 years. He also implored the father to seek effective help to control his temper and his frustration. Turning to the next slide, the case of RECI 3 and C4, again, involved the same father, but a different mother and different children. In this hearing, the mother of the two children, who were aged 6 and 8, applied to extend an existing Section 9114 order for a period of 5 years. The father was also applying for permission to bring a child arrangements application, and the mother also sought an extension or making of a new non-molestation order in the same terms as one which had been made in 2016. Mr. Justice Keane, in this case, found that the defects in the father's personality and his character were such that he posed a really serious risk of emotional and psychological harm to the mother. He therefore did extend the 9114 order for a period of 2 years. Unfortunately, however, in the absence of any further incidents since 2016, there was no legal basis for making or extending a non-molestation order. Now, there were some other cases which were heard in the last 12 months dealing with Section 9114 applications. I haven't got time to go into these in detail, but just to mention a couple. There's the case of Re-N, which was an appeal to the Court of Appeal by a father against the dismissal of his application to vary a Section 9114 order. That was appeal was allowed and the matter remitted for a further hearing. And then also the case of Re-P and N, which was a mother's appeal from a decision permitting the father to apply for a Section 8 order whilst a Section 9114 order was in place. That appeal was also allowed and the matter remitted for a rehearing.
Thank you, Victoria. Based on this recent case law, do you think it's fair to say that it's still very difficult to obtain a Section 9114 order, or has the scope now widened?
Thank you. Yes, I wouldn't say that these cases have widened the scope. The courts have been very clear that these orders are a last resort and should only be made where absolutely necessary. But I think an interesting point regarding these two cases was in RECI 1 and C2, there hadn't been a significant history of repeated applications by the father that you might normally expect in this type of case, whereas that had been the case in RECI 3 and C4, where the father had made numerous applications and appeals. In the case of RECI 1 and C2, the court applied the guidance in REPI, which said that there doesn't necessarily have to be repeated and vexatious applications for this type of application to be successful. It can also be made where it's considered in the children's best interest to prevent future unmeritorious applications being brought. So I think it's just these are useful cases in evaluating the different types of circumstances where this order might be appropriate.
So going on to slide 10, and we're looking at parental alienation, and I'm going to talk about the case of Ries. The next slide, I've set out the definition of parental alienation that's been given to us by CAFCAS, and I'll just read that out really quickly. So when a child's resistance or hostility towards one parent is not justified and is the result of psychological manipulation by the other parent. Now that manipulation can be intentional or non-intentional. Moving on to the next slide, and specifically the case of Ries, the facts of which were somewhat unusual. We have a 9-year-old daughter who was living with both parents, although her main carer was her mother, and her mother adhered to a system of beliefs called universal medicine. Now, this was a system that was set up, founded in Australia, and in 2018, there was a case in New South Wales that found that universal medicine was a harmful cult, and the founder was a sexually predatory charlatan. The system itself has some strong rules or beliefs on every aspect of life, including how to work, how to spend your money, and importantly, in this case, what food you eat, and for example, what direction you should be walking around shops. They also had a very negative outlook on people who don't adhere to that system of beliefs, looking at them as ill or lost. Now, the court did find that the child was being exposed to the system of beliefs by the mother, and that this was having a negative impact on her relationship with her father, who she was starting to view as someone outside that belief system. I've set out in detail on the slide some the key findings that the court did make, including that the universal medicine was a harmful cult. The mother was an uncritical adherent to that, so she was still happily, strongly believing in it herself and practicing the beliefs, and she was exposing the child to those beliefs. Now, the judge found at first instance that that was causing harm to the child and the alienation had already begun. The court also had to assess the risk of harm of transferring residence to the child and did find that the child would suffer harm, at least in the short term, if her residence was transferred to her father. Despite that, the judge did not make any change to the arrangements for the child's care and instead relied on the fact that he would be receiving undertakings for the mother in respect of her own practice of universal medicine and not exposing the child to that. Now, the father appealed that decision, and the Court of Appeal went through the judge's findings. And unusually, and you'll see on the next slide, I've set out the findings. The Court of Appeal found that all of the findings of the judge in terms of the cult and risk of harm should remain, that they were correct. But they did find that the judge had fallen into error in his assessment of how the balance of harm of the child and leaving the arrangements as they were. So the judge had not adequately balanced the risks of harm, and that undermined his decision. So the appeal was allowed. The Court of Appeal did not go so far enough as to actually change the order that the judge had made, but they remitted the case for another hearing, but on a very limited basis, leaving all of the findings intact. Actually, the Court of Appeal went a bit further than that in this case and said that unless the mother was going to make significant changes to her own lifestyle, then the inevitable consequence of that was going to be that the child's residence was going to be changed to the father.
Thank you, Emma. What lessons can we learn from this case about the court's willingness to order a transfer of a child's residence where findings have been made of parental alienation?
I think it's not very common that we're going to have cases where the alienation is so obvious. But I think that we what we can take away from that is that where alienation has been found, the court will want to be taking steps to address that harm, and particularly looking at the long-term effects of that alienation and the relationship with the other parent, as against any short-term harm the child may suffer by going through those the change of residence, for example.
The first case that I'm going to be talking about is the case of F and M. Now, this was an appeal brought by a father against a finding of fact made by the trial judge, Her Honour Judge Scully, that he'd raped the mother. These proceedings concerned the party's two-year-old child, who was conceived as a result of the sexual intercourse, which was at the heart of the judge's finding. On the PowerPoint slide, I've copied the exact wording of the finding, which, as you'll see, refers to the Act, which is the Sexual Offences Act 2003 and the criminal definition of rape. I'll move on to that in more detail in a second. Now, turning to the next slide, during the fact-finding hearing in the lower court, which itself was a rehearing, the judge heard evidence from both parties, read numerous text and WhatsApp messages sent by the parties, and also listened to their police interviews. The mother's case was that, after a short time engaged in sexual intercourse with the father, she told him that she didn't want to continue. She told him to stop, but when he continued, she told him that she didn't want him to ejaculate inside her. The father denied that she'd ever asked him to stop, although stated that before they had sexual intercourse, that they had agreed that he wouldn't ejaculate inside her, and him doing so was an accident. The mother then told the court that they went on to engage in penetrative sex at least once more, something which the father actually denied. After they parted ways, the parties exchanged messages, which the judge reviewed, and that included messages from the mother confirming that she'd asked him to stop and he hadn't listened. The trial judge had found that the parents had initially engaged in consensual intercourse, but that partway through the act, the mother had withdrawn her consent and the father had failed to stop, failed to withdraw, and such that the intercourse was no longer consensual and therefore he'd raped her. In his appeal, the father said that the judge hadn't properly considered all of the evidence, and in particular the inconsistencies in the mother's evidence. Further, he said that the ejaculation on his part was an accident, and the judge hadn't made a determination as to whether it was intentional or accidental. Mr. Justice Cobb heard the appeal. He noted that appeals against findings of fact are notoriously difficult, as you know, we will know from our own practice. He referred in this case to NG and SG, where Mr. Justice Mostyn said that an appellate court would only be able to say that the fact finder has plainly got the wrong answer if, number one, his conclusion was demonstrably contrary to the weight of the evidence, or number two, the decision-making process can be identified as being plainly defective so that it can be said that the findings in question are unsafe. He also pointed out that the fact-finding judge has a considerable advantage over the appellate judge in seeing and hearing the parties giving their evidence. Mr. Justice Cobb concluded that the trial judge had found both parties hadn't been entirely honest in their evidence and had given herself an appropriate Lucas direction. Further, said that she'd properly considered the burden and the standard of proof, carefully evaluated the evidence and written a thorough judgment. Now, moving to the next slide, Mr. Justice Cobb stated that the conclusion that the mother had been raped did not depend on a finding that she had given conditional consent to sex on the basis that he wouldn't ejaculate inside her. The conclusion was instead founded on the fact that partway through, she ceased to consent to the act. She made this known to the father by asking him to stop. However, the continued penetration became a serious sexual assault, which in criminal law is classed as rape. The father's appeal was therefore dismissed. And interestingly, this case examined the interrelationship between criminal and family jurisdictions. In this case, the trial judge had referred to the statutory definition of rape as per the Sexual Offences Act, and the appellate judge was not persuaded by the father's argument that the trial judge was wrong to do so. Mr. Justice Cobb referred to the case of Re-R, where Sir Andrew McFarlane stated that it's fundamentally wrong for the family court to be drawn into an analysis of factual evidence in proceedings relating to the welfare of children based upon criminal law principles and concepts. I think in this case, a need was identified for reference to a criminal legal definition where there wasn't an equivalent in the family courts. However, the court was very careful to clarify that the family court shouldn't become too distracted by criminal legal concepts or drawn into that kind of an analysis. And turning to the next slide, I'm going to be talking briefly about the case of JH and MF, which is a case that you'll no doubt all be aware of, and most will have read the judgment. I haven't got time to go into significant detail about the factual background of this case, and would recommend that you read the judgment in full if you haven't done so already. This was an appeal from the Central Family Court following a fact-finding hearing heard before His Honour Judge Tolson QC in proceedings for a child arrangements order. The appellant mother had alleged domestic abuse against the father, including two allegations of rape. These weren't found proven at the conclusion of the fact-finding, and in considering the mother's appeal, Ms Justice Russell, the appellate judge, identified a whole host of criticisms of the trial judge. These included that he had ignored special measures, that he'd failed to bear relevant definitions in mind, that he'd placed insufficient or no weight on corroborative evidence and undue weight on irrelevant matters, that the judge gave insufficient reasons for not finding the allegations proved, particularly in relation to controlling or coercive behaviour, that the judge placed undue weight on the demeanours of the parties in court when assessing their evidence, that the judge failed to take into consideration the fact that the father had previously and repeatedly been involved with the police relating to incidents of domestic violence and harassment, that the judge was wrong to make findings on matters that weren't put to the mother, and then finally that the judge was wrong to find that the mother had not been subjected to sexual penetration without consent and therefore raped by the father. Accordingly, the appeal was allowed and a retrial was ordered. Now, Ms Justice Russell also discussed the use of criminal legal principles by the family court in undertaking fact-finding exercises. She said that whilst a trial in the family court should not set out to replicate a criminal trial or apply criminal law or statutes, it cannot be lawful for the family court to take a wholly different approach, which is at odds with that in the criminal jurisdiction. Ms Justice Russell also finalised her judgment by stating that she'd made an urgent request to the President, who is going to make a formal request to the Judicial College, for those judges in the family court who may hear cases where allegations of serious sexual assault have been made to be given training based upon that which is already provided to criminal judges.
Thank you, Victoria. And do you think that the request for judicial training will go far enough to address the shortcomings of judicial understanding and these issues?
I think it remains to be seen. It's certainly a positive step in the right direction. But I think that it begs the question why it's been left so late, why this training is only, a referral for training has only just been given. And considering that issues like this, especially in undertaking fact-finding exercises, are regularly dealt with by the family courts. So I think, you know, we will wait and see, but it's definitely something that has been long awaited.
Thank you. I can move on to the next slide, that's slide 19. You'll see that I'm going to look at some cases about involving transgender issues. And I've actually listed two separate cases there. McConnell, which we may all be familiar with, had a lot of press coverage, but also WFC and D. And now on the next slide, and I'm predominantly going to be dealing with McDonnell when I'm looking at the law here, I've set out Section 9 of the Gender Recognition Act, followed by Section 12, and I think it's quite useful to look at those two together when we consider the issues that the court was considering in this case. I've also set out Article 8 of the European Convention of Human Rights, as again, that was important consideration. So the next slide, so moving on to slide 21, sets out the basic facts and outcomes in the case of McConnell. So we had a man who had transitioned from a female and had obtained a gender recognition certificate under the Gender Recognition Act. And that means, in accordance with Section 9.1, that for all legal purposes, they are to be recognised as the acquired gender. Now, there is an exception to that set out in Section 12, which if we can just momentarily go back to the previous slide, you'll see says that the fact that a person's gender has become the acquired gender under this Act does not affect the status of the person as the father or mother of a child. And it was the interplay between Section 9 and Section 12 that was a relevant consideration for the court in this case. So McConnell was an appeal against a decision of the president of the family division for judicial review of a decision made by the registry office. So after transitioning and obtaining the gender recognition certificate, The appellant had given birth to a son. And when it came time to register themselves on the birth certificate, they wanted to be known as the child's father in accordance with their acquired gender. However, the registry office said that they had to be registered as the child's mother. The appellant argued that as a matter of interpretation of the law of Section 9 and Section 12, he could be listed as an alternative, either the father, parent, or gestational parent of the child. The president, in considering that, decided that that was not the correct interpretation of that piece of legislation, and it was not the way that it was intended to be implemented. He also made an assessment as to whether that was in breach of the appellant's and the child's rights under the European Convention of Human Rights and decided that it was not. On appeal, the Court of Appeal went through the principles of judicial interpretation and carefully analysed the law and the conclusions that the president had made and found that his interpretation was correct. And upheld the decision that the law, the registry office had interpreted the law correctly in insisting that this parent should be listed as the child's mother. They also did an assessment of whether the decision was in breach of the appellant and child's human rights, specifically under Article 8. And interestingly, they found that having to put down a gender that was not your acquired gender on a formal document such as a birth certificate was a significant interference with that person's Article 8 right. However, human rights requires a further assessment as to whether that is justified under Article 8.2, and the court found that it was justified, therefore it was not a breach of the convention right. Just moving on then to the second case I want to look at, it actually breaks down into three cases. And it's, again, predominantly addressing transgender issues, but it's one that you might not have sort of picked up on. So this predominantly relates to changing children's names and using the deed poll process to do that. So the first case I want to look at is Reed W. And the issue was that when you change a name by deed poll, it has to be published in the London Gazette with the full old name and the full new name. And the issue with that is when you've got someone transitioning, it will become apparent that they are going from one gender to the next. Now, under Section 22 of the Gender Recognition Act, it's actually an offence to put that type of information about someone in the public domain. And the court here quite rightly said that's not compatible and that was against convention rights, the Article 8 right to family life. And what they said is that what should happen is that the London Gazette would still require some form of recording of the name change, but you could leave out the first name, both on the old first name and the new first name, so you wouldn't have that type of outing that the Gender Recognition Act was trying to protect against. It also suggested that the court papers should be made private in such cases, and that that issue should apply whether you're changing a name for children or for adults. The second case is again the name, a name change for a child who transitioned, except this time the child was 17. And in submitting the paperwork, the court is required to give consideration to the views of a child over the age of 16. But there doesn't seem to be any mechanism or clear way for that opinion of the child to be sought or made clear. So the court had to remit it to the family and say, you need to find a way, you need to make sure that this child's view is made clear. And then once that is established, the recording of the name change should be the same as in Reed W. The last case is another name change, although not in relation to a transgender transition. The mother in this case wanted to change the child's name because the father had committed sexual assault and had nothing to do with the family, but still had parental responsibility. And again, this case showed that there are some perhaps gaps where guidance would be beneficial both to the court and to families in relation to issues of changing children's names. In particular, how to assess the wishes and feelings of children who are under the age of 16, because that's not currently a requirement for going through the process by deed poll. And the parents should consider the family courts as an alternative to using a deed poll process because it's private in nature. It also said that parents weren't really understanding the concept of parental responsibility and that some further guidance would be helpful for that. So I think I've included these cases not only because they show from a transgender issues perspective that there are still scenarios that we are working to accommodate, but also there are wider issues about understanding family law and particularly parental responsibility that perhaps further guidance for everyone would be beneficial.
Thank you. Just a quick question. In respect of the McConnell case, the law hasn't developed at a fast enough pace in this area. And what message do you think that cases such as this send to individuals who are in similar circumstances?
I think one of the points that was made by the Court of Appeal was that this is one person in one case. And whilst that's by no means in a unique situation, there are other people in the same situation. The court wasn't in a position to make such a sweeping change or finding to the way we interpret the law without there being a proper assessment of everyone's views on such an important matter. The definition of mother came under a lot of scrutiny, and the word mother appears 45 times in the Children Act. So this is whilst a narrow issue in this particular case, is actually a much wider issue, and it really felt that it was not the place of the judiciary to be making decisions that was going to have such a real change and impact in the way that the law is made. So I think the message probably is that if we are going to see changes to the law, we need to see that in Parliament rather than before the courts. But it goes a long way to highlight these issues, which are important. We need to have a system of law that does accommodate everyone. We made the decision a long time ago now, back in 2004, to introduce the Gender Recognition Act and allow people to change gender. And we need to make sure that that is followed through in the law. But as I said, it's probably a case of looking to Parliament rather than the judiciary for the changes that people in a similar situation may want to see.
Brilliant, thank you. Now moving to slide 23, the final section that I'll be talking about is regarding paternity deceit. And that is the case of AB and CD and C, which is a really interesting case that was heard in the High Court before Mr. Justice Cohen regarding paternity deceit. There were two judgments which I'll be talking about. So turning to the next slide, the factual background of this case is fairly lengthy, and I don't have time within this webinar to go into it in significant detail, although again, I would highly recommend that you read the judgment in full. Briefly, by way of background, however, this matter concerned a boy who believed that the husband of his mother was his biological father. However, when the child was conceived, the mother was having an affair with another man who is referred to as X, and he was the child's biological father. Just to note, however, that no DNA test was undertaken by X, and the fact that he was the biological father was an account given by the mother. The husband was also unaware at this stage as to the actual identity of X. The husband, at the time that the child was conceived, was unaware of the mother's affair, and the child was raised as the much-loved only child of both parties. Unfortunately, however, the parties did then separate, and following their separation, the husband began to hear rumours that the mother had been having an affair at the time that the child was conceived, and he asked her to agree to a DNA test, which she did, and he then discovered that he was not actually the biological father. He was obviously devastated by this news, and he proceeded to issue a whole raft of proceedings against the mother. These included proceedings in the Chancery Division for breach of confidence, proceedings in the Queen's Bench Division for damages for distress, and also claiming back all the money he'd spent on the child in the mistaken belief that he was his. Financial remedy proceedings, and then Children Act proceedings. In respect of the latter, the principal application here was for an order that the mother disclose X's identity so that the child could be told. The scale of these proceedings was therefore immense, and it also gave the judge concern as to how the husband might use the knowledge as to X's identity. The child himself was unaware that the husband wasn't his biological father, and they had a really close relationship. Initially, the husband had threatened to withdraw entirely from the child's life, but then he had a change of heart and decided that he would remain a central figure in the child's life. And that was agreed and supported by the mother, who said that that would be in the child's best interests. Also at the time of this judgment, it seemed that the biological father, X, knew nothing about these proceedings and also of the paternity of the child. Now, the husband said that the child needed to know who his father was as soon as possible by telling him both that he wasn't his biological father and also the identity of X, his biological father. The husband said that only when he knew the identity of X could he sit down with him and discuss the kind of role he wanted to play in the child's life, if any. But again, the judge didn't think that the husband would be capable of having this kind of sensible, rational conversation with X, given the strength of his feelings. The mother's position was that the child would simply not understand what would be meant by having two fathers in his life, and that they should wait for around 2 years when she said that he would understand better the genetic process. We actually don't know how old the child was at the time of this judgment, save for that he had not yet reached teenage years. The mother also said that in an ideal world, X's identity would be kept a secret from the child until he approached adulthood. And she said that now, in any event, was not the right time to tell the child anything, given that the parties were going through enormous amounts of litigation and tensions were extremely high. A guardian was appointed on behalf of the child at quite an early stage, and the guardian's proposal, as supported by the husband, was that the mother should, with professional assistance, try and agree a script with the husband and present that to the child, which would be the reality of his paternity. Her view was that the child had a right to this information, that it shouldn't be delayed, and by doing so, if it were to be delayed, it would increase the risk that the child was told and find out inadvertently from somebody else, and that would be hugely damaging to him. She also took the view that it would be better for the child to be told at his current age and developmental stage, as she said that he was more likely to be better at dealing with such a significant life event. The guardian also recommended that the child should be told both that the husband was not his biological father, as well as the identity of X at the same time. She said that by delaying the latter, that risked further harm to the child, although she did accept that the child might not want to know immediately the identity of his biological father, having found out that it wasn't the husband. And in that case, she said that he shouldn't be told until he wanted to know. Now, perhaps unsurprisingly, there appears to be no reported cases where these particular issues have arisen before. As you'll be aware, however, there are a number of cases which clearly establish that it is in a child's best interest to know the truth of their paternity. And in this case, the judge cited the 2007 case of Reedy paternity. In making his decision, Mr. Justice Cohen recognised how acutely difficult this matter was and the need to approach it with humility. He said that the starting point was that the child needed to be told sooner rather than later that the husband wasn't his biological father, and agreed with the guardian's assessment of the risks in delaying that. The much harder issue for the court in this case was the issue of X's identity and the disclosure. And as he was completely unaware of these proceedings at the time, it was impossible to know how he'd react to the news that he was the child's father. And we just didn't know whether he would want to play any role in the child's life. Mr. Justice Cohen concluded that it would be wrong to disclose X's identity until X's position was known. And he therefore drafted a letter to X seeking these answers, subject to both counsel's amendments. And that was to be sent to X by the mother's solicitor. The matter was listed for a further hearing in a few weeks' time, by which point they hope to have X's position. And an order was also made in the meantime, which involved the grant of parental responsibility to the husband and also a spend time with order. Moving to the next slide, the second judgment in this case, AB and CD and C number two, was when everybody returned to court. And in the meantime, X had responded to the letter. He unfortunately confirmed that he didn't recognise the jurisdiction of the courts of England and Wales to deal with this issue. And he also said that the allegations that he was the biological father had no iota of truth whatsoever. The parties had also agreed in the meantime the instruction of an independent social worker to assist them and advise them in breaking the truth to the child. Now, in light of X's denial of paternity, the mother asked the court to actually revisit its entire decision as to the disclosure to the child that the husband wasn't his biological father. She submitted that the whole process should be stopped, but this was declined by the court. The judge said that it was only a matter of time until the child found out from perhaps somebody else that the husband wasn't his biological father, and it was better that it was managed at that time to minimise the potential harm. Mr Justice Cohen stated that it also wasn't a foregone conclusion that the child would immediately want to know the identity of his biological father, X, when finding out that it wasn't the husband, and therefore that the mother must only reveal the identity of X to him as and when the ISW said it was right to do so, at that time and not before the husband would also be told of X's identity. It was made clear also by the judge that the time at which the child would be told of X's identity just couldn't be predicted. It could be a very short time, it could be in years to come, and it would completely depend on the child's reactions and needs.
Thank you. This is clearly a case that involves some very difficult questions in relation to what was best for this particular child. But what do you think is the most helpful thing that we could perhaps take from this case and apply to other cases where there are similar facts?
Yeah, I think that the take-home point from this judgment is that the court took a very sensitive, pragmatic approach towards the needs of the individual child and, importantly, his reaction to the initial news. It did lack significant certainty for the parents, as they just wouldn't know when he'd be told of X's identity, but the judge felt that ultimately this was the best approach for the child. I am curious, however, to know how in practice, the ISW will know when it's time to tell the child and when it's best for him, and how much ongoing work that will require. And from a practical perspective, it raises a whole host of questions, including the frequency of reporting and in the continuing role in his life. So it'd be interesting on a practical level also to know how that will pan out.
Okay, if I can just move on to the next slide. You'll see, we couldn't really do an update on case law at this time without mentioning COVID-19. And so I've just set out a few cases that have touched on issues that we perhaps wouldn't usually be talking about. So if I can move on to slide 27 now, and I've just set out very briefly four cases. The first one, Repeat, you're probably familiar with, which is, again, the president of the family division, considering whether a particular case was appropriate for a remote hearing. And whilst it's very helpful in assessing cases for remote hearings, we have to remember that this case dealt with a very complex issue of fictitious or induced illness and very complex allegations that perhaps would not be suitable for a remote hearing. It's also important to note that we have since had the remote hearing consultation to assist us in considering the appropriateness of cases for remote hearings going forward. Along similar lines of the case of ReQ, and this was an appeal against a decision to adjourn a hearing that a judge had only a few days previously deemed appropriate for a remote hearing. And basically in the time that decision had been made to the decision to adjourn, ReP had come out. I think it was considered a bit of a knee-jerk reaction to that. And the appeal was that the ReP had not been properly applied. And in actual fact, on appeal, it was assessed that it had been appropriately applied, but there had not been adequate considerations to other factors which had determined the decision to list it remotely in the first case. Those being failure of doing a process and the welfare of the child. The next case I want to mention is IN and DK, and this involved the removal of a child from this jurisdiction to Greece on the 20th of March, so 3 days before we went into lockdown. And the mother removed the child, arguing that she thought that the child would be at less risk of COVID-19 in Greece than in this country. And the judge found that that's simply not an acceptable reason to take a child away from their habitual residence and their father. And what the father did is he did apply for the child to be returned under the Hague Convention 1980 and started proceedings in Greece, but also issued proceedings in this country for an order for the child to be returned and a declaration of habitual residence. And Mostyn dealt with this, and he said that he was happy to grant the declaration of habitual residence, but that he had to allow the Hague proceedings in Greece to proceed rather than making an order for return, and that to do otherwise would be to preempt those other proceedings. So I think it's quite an important case if you are thinking about what steps to take, both in this jurisdiction and another jurisdiction where you have had wrongful removal of a child. The final case I want to mention, it's not a children case, it's a court of protection case, but it does involve wrongful removal, and I think it is a helpful a judgment. So it involved a man in his 60s who had dementia and lacked capacity, who had been wrongfully removed to this country from Spain. And a hearing was listed on the 25th of March, so just after we had gone into lockdown, to consider the return of this man to Spain. And the hearing was found to be ineffective because the court simply couldn't deal with the issue of return with so many uncertainties and with so many restrictions on travel and the situation with COVID-19, both here and in Spain at the time. So that hearing was ineffective, and the matter was effectively adjourned for 3 or 4 months to see what the situation would be like then. But what's important is that the applicants, those who had wrongfully removed the man here, had to accept that the fact that he was remaining in this jurisdiction for a longer period of time would have absolutely no impact on him being habitually resident in Spain. So he would not be acquiring habitual residence and could not be acquiring habitual residence here simply because the matter had been delayed. Okay, well, we've covered quite a lot. I hope you found that useful, and thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.